Welcome, everyone, to the first ever scholar series offered by the Lake State Library. This is so exciting. It's fantastic to see a really nice turnout, and just know that there's cookies and hot chocolate and all other kinds of things that you're welcome to enjoy. Before I introduce our featured speaker this evening, I just want to make a few remarks about how, you know, we just started this new set of outreach lectures this semester, and the response has been fantastic. I want to let you know that we'll certainly be doing this again in spring. We'll be doing a writer series, a poetry series, a scholar series, a sustainability series, and an artist series. So there will be at least 5 lectures, maybe more if it turns out we get the opportunity for that. So look for some posters to be made as soon as we get those lined up, and we'll do our best to promote. Those will certainly at least be listed on the library homepage as soon as we get them booked. Another thing, just a few housekeeping things. Please turn off your ringers on your cell phones. I want to let you know that all of the lecture series we do here in the library, they are recorded, and they will be available off of LakerCast, which will be, I thought it was going to be rolled out this week, but Allie had to go to a conference, so we're probably going to roll it out early next week, and we'll have that link right off of the library's homepage so that you'll be able to catch the audio and some of the photos and even some of the video from all of the lectures that we have hosted so far. With that said, I'm really honored to be able to introduce this evening's featured speaker. And before I get into the, I guess I'll start with the formal stuff first, and then I'll give you the real information. Dr. Gary Britton was a member of the mathematics department in the UW colleges from 1967. I believe that was the founding year, was it not, sir? Yes, it was. We'll say it was the founding year, through 2000, and served as department chair for 7 years. He earned his Doctor of Arts in Mathematics at the University of Northern Colorado. He is also active in the Mathematical Association of America. Okay, so that's the official stuff. So Gary was at the first campus that ever offered me the opportunity to be a library director, UW Washington County, and he was one of the most engaging faculty members. You think of, you know, a stereotype of math faculty, you know, and they're really, you know, very linear, you might say, you know, not necessarily have, you know, the all-encompassing, you know, liberal arts ability. This guy has it. So he was a great colleague, and he's not only interested in math, but he's interested in such a wide variety of subjects, and the ability to link one to another is just amazing. For instance, I've had Gary do several talks on the mathematical problems in the Dan Brown novel, The Da Vinci Code. That's a fantastic talk, and maybe you'll even refer to some of that here. If not, we'll have you back in the future. And Gary is also a balloon pilot. I don't know what a balloonist, a balloonite. He's from North Dakota, right? South Dakota. Sorry. That's like mixing up the UP and the lower UP. Verboten. So anyway, it is my pleasure to introduce Gary Britton.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, sir.
We'll try to tie a few of those things together later on in the talk. What I'd like to do, and feel free to move up to the front, particularly at the beginning, I'm going to be doing some things with soap bubbles. And if you want to see better, feel free. There's some chairs right up in front. And then I'm going to use these to illustrate some of the principles that we want to talk about tonight. But then afterwards, if the youngsters in the audience want to come up and actually try some of these things on their own, that's fine. And youngsters can be anybody from 1 to probably 75 tonight. Anyway, if we were to blow typical bubbles, most of you are familiar with, that you would take a ring like this and blow the bubble and you get a nice round sphere. Why is it a sphere? What would happen if we were to take something like a square and try to blow a bubble? Or something like this that's a little oval. Would we get an oval-shaped bubble? Or a little bit more extreme? If I use this to blow a bubble, am I going to get something that looks like a hot dog? Well, let's try it and see if this works. Sometimes these work better than others. It's still a sphere, isn't it? Okay, I wonder why that is. Let's try something else. What I have here is a pipe, double-ended, and I'm going to try to get soap film on both ends of that. Now watch carefully as I blow this, because once I start blowing, I won't be able to do much talking. And this is another one of those that sometimes works better than others. But try to watch both sides of this at the same time. Driving out here, my container of soap got a lot of extra bubbles in it. Going out pretty much the same at both sides, right? But hemispherical, circular, until a certain point. Now what's happening is one was getting bigger and the other one was getting smaller. If I can get it started again, I'll try to do it without stopping to talk.
Off to the other side.
The shape is still a sphere, and the part of the sphere from the bottom portion that's missing is what's on top. So if you were to take the soap from the top and the soap from the bottom and put them together, it would be a complete sphere. So if you could kind of shrink the pipe that's in between, that's what it would be. So, as you know, if you take a larger ball and slice off a piece of that, it's going to be almost flat at the top. So we'll quit on that one. The reason that happens is that the soap film works like elastic. Once I blow some air in there, the volume of air is fixed until I add some more air. For that fixed volume of air, the soap film wants to take the shape that will minimize the tension on that elastic. And this shows that the most efficient shape, that is, that takes the least amount of material to enclose a given amount of volume, is a sphere. If you could, if we all lived in dome houses, for example, there would be less material used in the walls of that house than the kinds of houses that we live in. I mean, there are obviously a lot of other constraints that go into building dome houses, but in terms of the amount of material in the walls and the ceiling, the dome would be the most efficient shape. All right, let's look at something else then in terms of this. What I have is a pair of plexiglass plates and four screws in them. And these are going to serve as kind of anchor points for some of the soap film. I'm going to drop this in the soap film and pull it out. And again, as I said, this driving out here, I got some extraneous bubbles. I'll try to get rid of most of them. And then I'm going to put it on the projector. And I want you to watch what happens and the shape that it takes. And I may be able to hold it up. So at least those of you in the front can see it forming. Bear with me here, and we may have to do multiple tries. And Mark, I apologize if I drip some soap on your carpeting here. Now, ignore the little bubbles and take a look at, and unfortunately not everything on this, you can see where the corners are, like right here where I'm pointing. Okay, that's one of the anchor points, and you can see the soap film is coming up, and I've got some...
Should we move it closer so that the whole image is on, or is it that it...
Well, I'm going to do this first, and then just let it settle for a little bit. It's slowly changing shape. And what is happening is, that's taking the shape that's going to decrease the tension on that circuit. So again, this is something like elastic. So what this means is that the route connecting these four points, that's the shortest total distance, is the shape that the soap film is taking. So if you had four cities in the Upper Peninsula that were arranged like this, and we're going to run power lines between those four cities to connect them, or roads, or whatever kind of network you wanted.
Trains.
What?
Rail.
Rail? Trains? Trains? That's the path that you'd want to lay that out of to make the distance the shortest. Okay? And what will happen is with soap film, it will always come together with three like that. When you're washing dishes or drinking a beer out of a clear bottle, take a look at how the bubbles join, and you'll see that there's three of them coming together like that. Okay? So now what's happened is it broke loose from one of them, and it's taking, it's reconfiguring itself, but it's still going to take the shape that's going to, well, no, I lost another one, but it would take a shape that would minimize the distance on that. Okay, so let's leave that.
So those were straight lines there, right? Weren't they?
Those were straight.
Yeah.
What it formed is the two would come from these points, they join in the middle, and then all three of those angles would be the same. It would be a 120 degree angle around, from, if you measure from one soap film to the next, 120 degrees, because there's 360 around the circle. So those would always be 120 degrees. Now, let's move into some other things about that. So what I want to do then is to show you some mathematics. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail in formulas or anything like that, but to try to relate how some of these things, some things in nature that we observe, and the arts, and how some of these are all related. So let's switch from that. As I said, afterwards, if you youngsters want to come up and try to blow some of those bubbles yourself, that's fine. So let's go on and look at the honeycomb. Look at the shape of the honeycomb. Notice that we've got three of them coming in together, equal angles around there, all the way through the honeycomb. The bees know that the most efficient structure for them to use to construct their honeycomb is this hexagonal shape. And that's the same shape that was starting to form with the soap film because of the efficiency of that. It takes a lot more energy for the bees to construct the wax than to make the honey. And so they want to use the least amount of wax in their honeycomb as they can so that the rest of their energy can be used for forming the honey itself. If we all go all the way back to Euclid, 4th century B.C., Xenodorus also found that the hexagon shape makes the most efficient use of space and building materials. One can prove that mathematically. We're not going to go through that proof tonight, but there's an example of it from nature.
You just contradicted yourself, Dr. Britton. I know I was supposed to save my comments until the end, but I could have sworn 5 minutes ago you said that a dome is the most efficient way to build a structure.
To enclose a certain volume. Okay? Here, what we're talking about is the honey is going to be in between two layers in the hive. Okay, so we're talking about length and not volume. You see it in architecture. It goes all the way back to the interior chambers in the dome of the Pantheon. An early example of honeycomb structure. Galileo made comments about how art and nature even more makes use of these in thousands of operations in which robustness is increased without adding weight, as is seen in the bones of birds and in many stalks that are light and very resistant to bending and breaking. 1665, Robert Hooke discovered the natural cellular structure of cork is very similar to that of a honeybee. Charles Darwin made a comment about the structure in the honeycomb. And today, it's used, if we go to something more modern, there's aluminum honeycomb cores. The honeycomb type material is used a lot in airplane structures. Why? Because you want it to be strong and lightweight as possible. So there's an example of how that same thing that we saw with the soap film goes through, and it's used in the honeybee structure, and then now in some modern technology on that.
Can I ask a question? Why is it fungus resistant? That middle point is. Why would that make it fungus resistant?
That wouldn't be. That was what I took that slide from, was an advertiser for that kind of material.
Oh,
they're
see.
Mentioning things other than that.
Okay.
No, the fungus resistant doesn't have anything to do with the fact that it's
okay.
That it's honeycomb. Let's look at bees to get us into another type of mathematics on that. It turns out that male sweat bees can be hatched from an unfertilized egg so that they only have a female parent.
Okay.
But a female sweat bee has both a male and a female parent. Don't ask me why, I'm not a biologist. So what I want to look at is the number of ancestors in each generation of a male sweat bee. And so I'm going to set up a table, okay? So bear with me on this. We start out with a male sweat bee. Now read up. This is in the first generation. a female parent. That male was hatched from an unfertilized egg, so we have one in the previous generation. Okay, we go up to the next generation beyond that, and this female has both a female and a male ancestor. Okay? So one female ancestor there. And if we keep doing this, this female has a female and a male. This male has a female ancestor. And in that generation, we have two female ancestors. And if we keep doing this and building our table, and I'm just looking up, this female has a female and a male. This male has a female. This female has a female and a male. And we have three female ancestors in that generation. And if we keep doing this, and I'll speed it up a little, and if you go through and count all of those, this is the sequence we get for the number of female ancestors. Okay? So kind of keep those in the back of your mind. We'll come back to that in a little bit later. I want to now look at the number of male ancestors in each generation. So if we count across and count the males in each generation, we get 0, 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8. It's the same numbers, but it's not lined up with the same generation as it was before. And then if we look at the ratio of female to male ancestors in each generation, if I divide the number of female by the number of males, 1 divided by 1 is 1, 2 divided by 1 is 2, 3 divided by 2 is 1.5, and you keep on going back, and it looks like these numbers are getting closer and closer to 1.6. Okay? And if we look at the number of ancestors of, remember that previous one I did was a female sweat bee. If we go through this one more time, but now for, and we start out with, one before was for males. If I start out for a female sweat bee, okay, a female sweat bee, remember, has a female and a male for the first generation previous. And we keep adding additional generations, and you see that what happens is you get the same set of numbers. And if we add the males just like we did before, same set of numbers, but from that, and we look at the ratios, we get the same thing. The ratios get back. So I want to do quite a bit with that set of numbers. Take a picture of the Chambers Nautilus, kind of picture it in your mind. We'll come back to something that's similar to that as we go on. The sequence of numbers that I've just introduced is a Fibonacci sequence. 1, 1, 2, 3. And if you look at that long enough, or those of you that have studied some mathematics may know, what would the next number in the sequence be that I don't have up there? 34. And how'd you get that?
13 plus 21.
Okay. Okay. You're adding 1 and 1 is 2, 1 and 2 is 3, 3 and 5 is 8, and so forth. So that's named after Leonardo of Pisa, Italian mathematician back in the 11 and 1200s. What I want to do is to use those in some geometry and construct some squares. This is known as a tiling. A tiling of a shape is anytime you take tiles and can completely fill the shape. So if I start out with tiles, and let me go to the next slide, which is that same picture, but a little larger. One, two, these squares, this is dimension 2, twice the size of this. And then if I take the 2 and the 1, that's 3. And then the two and the three, that's five. And I keep putting these squares around there. We get a tiling of the plane. I mean, you could do your kitchen floor that way if you wanted to, right? But what I'm going to do then is to construct a circle, a quarter circle, within each one of those squares. So I'll take this, draw a quarter circle, quarter circle, quarter circle, and there it is. There's a quarter circle here. So this spiral is built on the Fibonacci sequence. Because each one of these, remember we constructed these squares by using the Fibonacci numbers, adding the two previous squares, and then we constructed that spiral, and you keep on going, and that has a shape very similar to the chambered nautilus. It also appears in other things in nature. If you look at the spirals in the seed heads of a lot of flowers, this is a sunflower seed, obviously. And if you look at the arrangements of the spirals around there, in a lot of them, if you count the number of different spirals, you'll find that it's a Fibonacci number. Let's move into a little different type of art. You had a poetry session as part of this series.
Yeah, we had two of them.
Yeah, two of them. Okay. Well, then we don't want to ignore poetry for the arts here. Fibonacci poems are called fibs. If you do a Google on fibs or fib poetry, you'll find a lot of these. You'll probably find a website that you can enter and write your own. Or compete. And what it is the number of syllables in each line equals the total number of syllables in the preceding two lines. So it's structured based upon the number of syllables. Kind of like haiku is based upon the number of syllables in each of these. So let me give you some of these. Here's an example. What is a fib? A poem, mathematical. Syllables are arranged in lines according to Fibonacci sequence of numbers. 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 31, 34, 55, and so on. And if you count the number of syllables in each of those lines, it would fit the Fibonacci sequence. Now, you've got to stop pretty soon because you can imagine those lines get terribly long if you go a couple more lines on this. But let's look at another one. Well, there's the one if you want to count that one, there should be eight syllables in that line on that. We're talking about art and nature, so let's look at a fib that addresses both some art and some things from nature. My soul sings a symphony of perpetual omniscient narrative lyrics. Tones reminiscent of azure bluebird lullabies, enchanting like stars in indigo skies, and blossoming like fragile, fragrant bluebells. And if we're talking about poetry, you need to talk about love. This is perhaps the absence of love rather than love, but in any case, our time cashed out way before the meter expired, sending our deems summer streams somersaulting, helter-skelter to the whims of what never was planned, leaving fairy tales breathless, our favorite song weeping still in the landfill of love. And you can find these. So have some fun. Try to write some of your own. All right. Let's go back to the ratio of the successive Fibonacci numbers. These are the numbers that I came up with when we were looking at the sweat bees. These are the ratios when we were looking at the number of males to females in each generation. And this is what that ratio is. I'm now reading from top to bottom. This goes 1 to 1.619, 1.618. These are converging very closely down here to those last three numbers. And it turns out that it converges exactly to 1 plus the square root of 5 over 2, which is 1.6180, so very close to what that last number is. All right. Where does that come from? Or what's it related to? You may have heard of the divine proportion, or the golden ratio. If you were to take a line, any length, and cut it so that the ratio of the entire line to the longer segment is the same as the ratio of the longer segment to the shorter segment. So in this case, I've done this on a computer, so it was measuring pixels. So I've got AC, I've got CD, certain number of pixels, and if I take the ratio of those, it turns out that AB, that's the entire length of the segment, divided by AC, that's the longer of the divided segments, that ratio is 1.62. If I take the long segment divided by the shorter segment, that's 1.62, that's the same. So that's divided according to the golden ratio of the divine proportion.
Gary, I'm sorry, I need you to try to explain the placement of the different sections again. I didn't get it. Right, so like what
you start with a line, yeah. And if I cut it off way up here and did the same thing, the ratio of AB to AC would be almost one. It would be about the same. Because if I have this point C up here and I'm looking at the ratio of AB to AC, they're about the same length. So what I'm saying is if you slide this point C back until a point where these two ratios are the same.
Okay, you're bending my brain, but I see.
Good, that's what it's a scholar program,
so
right?
You can move the C around and then it changes to different ratios, but you're saying when you get it to the point where those two
are the same.
Got it. Now I understand, sir.
Okay. It's called the golden ratio. There's the exact number. It's approximately, if I were to round this off to the same number of digits that I have in the diagram, that would round off to 1.62. Okay, so it's close enough of what we want to do. All right. That number appears in a lot of art.
So is there a way of knowing where you should divide the line, or do you just have to go down the line at every single point and just enter it in and then
no,
figure out
where
the proportions
where
work?
Where y squared equals x.
If you were to draw a line, say 1 inch, say a foot long, okay, and make that be AC, then the entire line would be 1.62 feet. Okay, that would be the easiest way to do that. As I was saying, it shows up in a lot of art, okay? And there are a lot of people that feel that if you were to take it, I'll show you a picture of a rectangle in a minute, but that a rectangle that's set up with this ratio is the most pleasing rectangle to look at. And so it appears a lot in architecture and early, even early architecture, okay? We saw it earlier in this ratio. There's a rectangle. And if I had one of my mathematical programs here, I could actually drag this point and show you how everything changes and stays in that ratio. But this point is the length of this, and then the height. And if I were to drag C, the ratio of those two would stay in that golden ratio. Okay. So that's the shape of a rectangle that would meet this pleasing criteria. No?
One last question, and I'll shut up, okay? Is that the ratio that motion picture screens are set at? I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, wow,
but keep in mind that motion picture screens are, let's talk about television screens, have changed. Television screens were on a 16:9 ratio, and then they were on 4:3, they've gone to 16:9. Okay, that's not, it's close, but it's not that ratio, no. Here's an example back to the Parthenon, where the Fibonacci numbers in that spiral are superimposed on the Parthenon, and you can see some of those shapes occurring there. Thanks to my wife Jean and doing some reading, she discovered that there are references to Debussy that he used the golden ratio in a lot of his musical compositions. There's two of the most famous ones, Clair de Lune and La Mer. Several people claim that Debussy structured parts of his music mathematically on that, using the golden ratio in the Fibonacci sequence. I'm not a musician. I'm not going to go into detail on that part, but for those of you that are, you want to do any research, you can look at that. Mark, you said you weren't going to ask any more interruptions.
Right, this is not an ask, this is a statement. As a faculty member that had worked at a library that I worked at, I can't believe you're studying Wikipedia in a presentation in my library.
Oh.
But I'll forgive you for that.
Okay, sorry about that.
That's all right.
All right, all right. I will look for a different reference next time.
That's got to be one.
Okay.
Wikipedia is usually like 98%.
All right. There are a lot of scales that use the Fibonacci numbers and a lot of songs. Here's an example from Mary Had a Little Lamb, five notes. Ring Around the Rosie, Go Tell It to on the Mountain. So those are other examples in art where the Fibonacci numbers appear. Amazing Grace. In scales, I'm not going to go into details on this either, some of the scales use numbers related to the Fibonacci. Diatonic scale, chromatic scale. The use of proportion, not always the golden ratio proportion, but other scenes from proportion. Vitruvian Man in Da Vinci's notes has all kinds of references to proportion in there, and art students, when they study art, that's one of the things that they learn. I want to talk a little bit about symmetry. Symmetry plays a big role in mathematics, but also a big role in art and nature. Here's a Cecropia moth that's on a milkweed plant. And if you look at the milkweed plant, the leaves are arranged very symmetrically, two, and then rotated, and then two. The design of the moth a lot of other butterflies, very symmetric. Other places is perspective in art. A lot of mathematics involved in that. There's a couple of drawings. We have an art contest on our campus every year, and these are just two of the pictures that I took of high school student artwork, where they have used perspective in their designs and drawings. A lot of mathematics involved in the background there. Here's some symmetry, it caught my eye. It's not symmetrical in the sense of color. but it's very symmetrical in the sense of the design and the shape on that. Mark mentioned that I did fly hot-air balloons, and I want to use this as an example to talk again about design and the symmetry involved. When we talk about reflective symmetry, that means you could put a mirror someplace in the object, and the reflection and the object would appear the same. So in this balloon, I'm going to show you two pictures of balloons, the last two balloons that I flew. Yeah, where I put the yellow line in there, if you were to think of that as a mirror, the design on the right could be the image of the portion on the left. Okay? Likewise, if you were to put a mirror horizontally through that little burgundy panel, and I don't know what the lighting in here, if you can tell that, but it's burgundy in the middle and then red above and red below. And then it goes to orange and then two yellow, orange and two yellow below, and then white and then another burgundy. So in this case, you've got reflective symmetry with two different possibilities, either the vertical mirror or a horizontal mirror. So we named that balloon reflection squared, keeping with a mathematical theme and the fact that there were two symmetries involved in there. Okay. Then when we wanted to do another balloon, okay, I was trying to think of something in doing reflections cubed in a three-way symmetry, but my wife had a little voice to change that approach. But anyway, what we ended up with is this balloon. There's no reflective symmetry in that. You can't find a place where you could put a mirror and have it look the same. But it does have what's called rotational symmetry. In mathematics, rotational symmetry is if you put an axis through something and rotate it, it looks the same. So here, there are 24 what are called gores in ballooning around this balloon that make the structure of it. It goes six with six colors and then starts over again with the same pattern. So there's 4 times 6, 24, all the way around that. So if you were to rotate that balloon, it would appear that it would be the same if you rotated it 90 degrees. It's going to look the same. Okay? So we named that balloon reflections free. Okay? There's no reflections in it whatsoever. If you look at it from the bottom as it's rotating, you can see the effect that that has. If you rotate it 90 degrees, it's going to look just like it did before. There are several other examples of symmetry in mathematics. If you graph functions such as an even function like this with all even powers, the graph is going to look symmetric. If you put a mirror down through here, it's going to look the same on each side. Or take another function, one of the trigonometric functions, symmetry plays a role there. Geometric figures, this icosahedron has 120 different symmetries. I'm not going to illustrate all of those, but by putting lines through there, you can have 120 different symmetries of that. And there's a branch of mathematics called group theory, which symmetry plays an extremely important role in that. Let me mention some other examples of things that I have not talked about tonight, which tie mathematics and art and nature together. The double helix spiral in DNA. Okay. The symmetry in chemical structures. Other scales, I mentioned a few of the scales, but other scales in music, frequencies, mathematics plays a lot. Let me show you a few other things from nature where symmetry plays a role. I've got a picture here of hepatica. Both the leaves and the blossoms The leaves have a one-axis reflective symmetry right there. If I draw, if I think of that as a mirror, it's going to look the same, okay? But there's no rotational symmetry in the leaves. No matter how much you rotate it, you're not going to get the same image until you rotate it all the way back 360 degrees, which is essentially what you started with. So there's no rotational symmetry there. However, if you look at the blossoms have both reflective symmetry and rotational symmetry. You've got rotational symmetry of 60 degrees. If you take one of these blossoms and rotate it 60 degrees, it's going to look just like it does now. Okay? There's six petals, 6 times 60, 360 degrees in the complete circle. Okay? And 12 different axes of reflective symmetry. I could take a mirror and put it here. I could put the mirror in between two of the leaves, or petals. I could put it to the next petal, all the way around. So we've got 12 different reflective symmetries in that blossom. And I'm just showing you another one there. This is a picture of a few other flowers from my yard. Notice the symmetry in the butterfly. And then in the butterfly weed, and I'll show you a close-up of this a little bit. There's five petals in each of those flowers. This has eight petals. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then the one that was here, missing. So there's 8, 5, and 8. Where'd those two numbers come from? Fibonacci sequence. There's the butterfly weave. Every one of those has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 5 petals in all of those. Okay. Branched cone flowers, 8. And not everyone is going to be exactly the same, but predominantly those have 8 in them. Another species with 8 petals, tall Coreopsis, the same type of thing. Spiderwort, 3 petals, one of the other Fibonacci numbers. Let me close with this example from the spherical flower heads of a rattlesnake master. Here we're back to a sphere, and then the symmetry of pattern in the red spotted purple admiral butterfly, completely symmetric all the way through on that. And with that, that's what I have prepared. I will take some questions if you want. And then when we finish, remember, you kids can come up and if you want to try some soap bubbles, you can do that. You can experiment on your own. You don't want to? All right. I'll bet you do. All right. Let me answer a couple of questions. Yeah.
Okay. I'll just start it off. Okay. Playing the devil's advocate here. Are you just choosing the 6 examples that you happen to find that happen to match your theory that the Fibonacci sequence is important in art? Because those flowers are important. Tell me, how do you know that it's really an important player, and why is it? If indeed you can sway me to that argument. Because you might just be cheering.
Let me respond to the why question first. If I remember correctly, there's a scene in one of the Indiana Jones movies in a classroom on archaeology where a student asks the question and the professor says, in this class we're dealing with facts. If you want to know the why of something, go down the hall to Professor Jones' philosophy class. Anyway.
I need to tell you the rest of that story, just so you know.
That's from Ripon College.
It's from Ripon College. Yeah, and the faculty member that he referred to is the one that he failed his class, and that's why he didn't graduate. Just so you know.
Yes. And that professor just passed away just recently, if I remember right.
But
if I've got the right professor. Anyway. Mark, to answer your question about these particular followers, obviously I've done some reading on Fibonacci numbers and some reference to these. And I have a prairie garden of native Wisconsin flowers with about 150 different species. So once I was aware that some of those had Fibonacci number petals, I started looking around. And then I started looking at the pictures I already had taken. When I took those pictures, it was not in anticipation of this talk. They're just pictures from my file of photos of my prairie garden. Are there some others that don't fit that? Yes. But it appears that it's occurring frequently enough that it's more than just happenstance.
I would say that for some that don't fit it, six-petaled, Lyle monocopter is six-petaled, but that's three petals and three sepals, with the three sepals looking like petals.
Uh-huh.
But with seedheads and such, it comes down to efficiency, just how things manage to fall together most efficiently.
Okay, good. There are also, if you do some of the reading on Fibonacci sequence and the leaf placement, that there's some, how the leaves are rotated around the stem related to the Fibonacci numbers as well. And I think that has some of that same reasoning behind it.
So why in art do you think you were visually drawn to that?
To the divine the golden ratio? Some things just seem to be more pleasing to look at than others. Right? What's that?
Beauty is also defined as perfect symmetry, right? So if you draw a line down the center, we're supposed to be symmetrical on both sides of our body. And some of us are more symmetrical than others. And so the idea is that those people who have the most embodied perfect symmetry are more beautiful.
Is that actually
Yeah, same thing with the gold ratio with the differences in like waist, hip, different sizes of how far your shoulders come through and things like that. Mostly that is to gold ratio compared to certain parts of your body.
I wonder if part of it could be cultural in that, let's say, the classical Greeks had a fad, let's say, of golden ratio stuff. And every few hundred years thereafter, people said, well, we want to go back to the classical Greeks and imitate their style. And could it get just ingrained in the culture in that way?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Good. Other comments? You're teaching me things.
like a picture, like you used to print out with film, like you take a picture.
It's
like 5 by 7 or 4 by 6. Which one would be closer to that rectangle? Oh, did you just say that?
No, I didn't. I don't know. I'd have to do the calculation,
no,
but
well,
you could.
Well, no, that's the same question, though, as the television, right?
Yeah.
Right? The one that's the wider rectangle. Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't think that the change to the wider had to do with how it viewed. Okay. I think it's more technology than.
You're a mathematician.
Yeah.
I'm putting you on the spot, sir. That's all right.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, I think that's it then.
Thank you very much.